Hello, this is Christina Arison, producer of The Mark Steiner Show. Coming up this hour, you'll hear an interview with Michael Lawrence, a local filmmaker whose latest project is a documentary called Bach and Friends. In it, he gathers some of the most renowned musicians of our time to reflect on Bach's legacy and give performances of his music. There are great classical players like Joshua Bell, Richard Stoltzman, and Hilary Hahn. But rounding out the film are a few surprises as well. You'll hear Bobby McFerrin, banjo player Bella Fleck, ukulele player Jake Shimbakuru, and many more. You can see Bach and Friends this Wednesday, March 16th, at 7 p.m. at Shriver Hall on the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University. For tickets or more information, www.shriverconcerts.org or 410-516-7164. We'll be right back with Michael Lawrence, but first, let's get you home safe with WEAA traffic.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a fascinating conversation about Bach, but more about a film about Bach. It's called Bach and Friends. It's a two-hour documentary on Johann Sebastian Bach, interviews and music from some of the finest musicians across this globe, produced and done by a filmmaker from right here in Baltimore, Michael Lawrence, on the eve of Bach's birthday. And Michael, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is a lovely little piece. I keep saying that to you before we started. So tell me a bit about what drew you to this. Well, let me take a step backwards. Because I think as you tell us that, your life started out in music.
That's
not
correct,
in film,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I'm from Indianapolis, and when I was a kid, I was
another Hoosier.
Another Hoosier.
I just left one at home.
And I was a bluegrass banjo player and a folk singer. Uh-huh. And at some point, somebody gave me a Swingle Singers album. I had never listened to classical music, or my parents didn't. Uh-huh. And I fell in love immediately with Bach, and started a lifelong love for the composer. And I ended up chasing the guitar and ended up studying with Aaron Shearer and graduated in his first classical guitar class at Peabody. And all the time, the music of Bach had grown and been part of my life, really kind of an obsession, especially with Glenn Gould. And so I switched over started composing scores for films, documentaries, and got really hooked on the process of making film and decided that was really what I wanted to do. And ironically, I bought my first 8mm camera from Aaron Shearer, my guitar mentor and master. And so I was offered set up the guitar department at the University of Maryland. When I turned it down, then I knew that was going to be a filmmaker. And so I just started. And I've been spending my whole life, making films.
And a lot of the history of your filmmaking, not all of it, but a lot of it has been around music.
Oh, yeah. It's always been a key. I would consider those two things the main driving force. In fact, early on I did a film called The Mind of Music.
Yes. I read about it on your site.
Yeah. And so.
Tell us about The Mind of Music.
Well, The Mind of Music it's a curious film. It had Dr. Lewis Thomas in it, who was one of the most interesting guys talking about music. And basically it explored what is this musical experience and why does it have such a profound control over us and why is it so meaningful. And I was lucky. I got Yehud Menuhin and had some interesting people in the film, Ed Polacek and people at Peabody.
Oh, I love Ed.
So, yeah, it was great fun to do. So that was one of the early films that focused just on that. I made a series of films, and then I started working with Julian Cranin, I had written the music for his film, The Other Americans, which won an Emmy, and Julian had won the Academy Award, and he was a big documentary guy. So it ended up that we started collaborating. So we made a series of films together. We made a film for the Library of Congress. We made the Quiz Show Scandal for the American Experience that was then made into Redford's film Quiz Show. And so Julian and I spent a number of years making documentaries together of all different kinds. And as I started getting older, I decided instead of trying to make network programs that would be bought by the broadcasters and so on, HBO and CNN and PBS, I decided that since I'm getting a little older now, I'm just going to do what I want to do. And so that was when I decided, what do I love the most? I love Bach. And so I decided that was what I was going to do.
So this is a labor of love. You just began this with some really fine people working with you in sound.
I began it with no funding, and I paid for all the first shoots. All the crew people worked on spec. I even did the catering for the first few shoots.
You're a good chef?
No. I mean, I bought the stuff and brought it in and put the cooler in and made sure everybody was happy. And the very first shoot we did was with Felix Hell, the organist. So that was what kind of started it. And so it was really kind of a wing and a prayer and just going, and it kept moving along. There was a guy in my Library of Congress film, a guy named Richard Saul Werman, who invented the TED conference. And he'd been a good friend of mine for years. And he really picked up on what I would do is whenever I would do a shoot, I would put up a basic cut on the website to try to get interest and excitement and get funding especially. And Richard turned me on to the EG conference, which is another TED-like kind of thing. And I presented a sample reel of about 10 minutes of the very first shoots. And after the screening, a guy came up to me and handed me his card, and he said, I'll help you out. And it was John Abley, who is the founder of Boston Scientific, a billionaire. And he gave me $50,000, and all of a sudden I was off and running to make the movie. Yeah.
So talk about the how you began this and your first interviews. Because interesting, it was on the organ, because the organ, the piece that you talked about in the film around the organ, I found fascinating in terms of what it said about Bach and that piece and that instrument in that time.
It's interesting. I almost hate all Bach organ music. It all sounds like funeral parlor music. And I mean, I hate to put the organ players down, but I don't know why the music isn't more appealing when you think of the being written by the greatest composer alive. But Felix really knows how to do it, and that's what he opens up with his C major fugue. And it's snappy, and it's sharp, and it sounds so different than much of the organ music. So that was basically the starting point of the film. And we filmed it over at Peabody, and it was great to get to know Felix, who's become a dear friend. And this is a kid from Germany that was playing when he was 12 years old or something like that, and got 10 CDs out already, and he's really the most exciting young organist.
what I found so fascinating about his particular part of the film were a couple of things. One was I never, until that day, I've watched people play organ in people's churches when I've gone to visit a church or something. And I, you know, used to love, was a big fan of Jimmy Smith growing up as a kid, and Bach and Schweitzer's organ music. But I never saw somebody play it like that. I never understood the complexity of playing the organ with your feet and your hands and how he did it and what that said about the composer Bach himself.
But, you know, it's interesting. The reason nobody really sees the footwork is these consoles that they sit on cover up the feet entirely. So when you're in the audience or in the back of a church, you don't really see what's going on with the feet. So, of course, we took that out and put a 2x4 up there and were able to film all of the Felix's amazing kind of footwork. And then when you combine that with the complexity of the three different keyboards and so on, I mean, it's really, really quite an exciting thing to see.
I mean, his feet were like dancing.
And one of the things that's nice about this film is that we use these little cameras. So they're so small that you can hold them anywhere you want to, and they have stabilization in them, so you can essentially get shots that you normally never could get with the film. Little, believe it or not, it's about a $3,000 camera, and it's a high-definition camera. It's a Panasonic VHS 100, and when they showed the film at the Charles Theater, this is a big movie screen.
Yeah, yeah.
It looked as good as feature film. I mean, it was shocking that you can shoot.
And you're a filmmaker and you're shocked.
Instead of a Panavision camera. You know, generally Richard Chisholm, who is the director of photography, and I, we would shoot with two cameras all the time. And so what we would do, for example, with Felix, we shot probably a dozen takes of him playing that entire piece. So when I went back to – that means we had two cameras going. So we had 24 different versions of that piece. So I could go back into an editing system on the Mac – line all 24 of those tracks up, put measure numbers on it, and look at the choice as an editor to find the best shots and to put together a version of that. So, I mean, that's only with this kind of, you know, video editing can you do that kind of thing, or computer editing.
One of the things he said is when he was describing Bach and the organ, it was describing Bach as a geek. That the organ was the computer of its day, the complexity of it.
It was the most complex mechanism.
Early 1700s.
The most complex mechanism on the planet. And it ended up just being an organist, which is the way Bach started out, is that these things were breaking all the time. You had to know how to deal with them. And he had an uncle, Uncle Christoph, who essentially he learned all about how to do it. So he, you know, became a techie. He had to fix pipes and do this and do that just to get them playable, you know. So he became one of the main, throughout his life, one of the main consultants to new organs and to, you know, judging what kind of organ to put in and then evaluating them once they're placed in. And so he, that was his side, one of his side jobs was as an organ consultant.
I guess people, everybody knows the name. There's very few people who don't know the name Bach, who don't know, maybe never heard his music, but know the name. And Johann Sebastian Bach, but it's the collective understanding from all these dozens of people that you interviewed has to do with the power of his music and how and what he composed and his improvisation that can not just challenge his world but help define music since then. That's the sense I got from this.
Absolutely. And even he summed up everything that came before him, and he set up most of what was going to come afterwards. And every composer after Bach had to deal with him. And it was not only that he was the greatest craftsman. I mean, he's just an unbelievable level of skill and complexity in dealing with these different forms. But the fact that he could make the music so emotional and so personal and so spiritual and so consistently interesting and moving, that was the thing that made him different than any other composer. I mean, you know, Handel and Telemann, these guys are great composers and everything, but nobody can even come close to what Bach was able to do.
You remember the conversation you had with Philip Glass?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Of course you do. You made the movie.
Another great composer.
If you think about the quantity of music that he composed, we can't really talk about composition in a normal sense. I think basically what Bach wrote down was what he heard. I don't think he ever composed anything. I think pieces arrived in his mind complete. There's no other way to explain the massive amount of music he wrote. when we talk about composition, I wouldn't say that he really composed in any way that you and I would think about composition, where you had to think about the structure or wonder what was going to happen next. I think, for example, the fugues, it seems, when I listen to them, it sounds to me he just heard them and he wrote them down. When you say, how could someone have done this? We're talking about a genius. We're talking now, what do we mean by that? You know, we mean that in the way we talk about, how did Einstein think of the theory of relativity? Well, he was a genius. How did he think of it? He says that he visualized it. And then he spent years trying to develop the mathematics to describe what he saw. Bach was given a beautiful system of notation that had developed over a number of years. He could go from the auditory vision to the notation without any, you know, process. He could hear it that way.
Well, he was saying that the form and the content is the same. And that's, he said, is a very modern notion, because a lot of composers today, the idea is that the structures that you work with generate what the music is. And, of course, with Bach writing a fugue, setting it all up, that structure kind of took over. I've got another theory. I don't know whether it's worth dealing with. But
sure, it's worth it. Go ahead.
Okay. There's a lady wrote a book just recently I read, and she was trying to deal with what is it in these genius composers that gives them some kind of a transcendent or hallucinogenic mm-hmm. kind of experience that makes them write better, more powerful music than anyone else. And she was using Chopin and some other composers as examples. Chopin supposedly had some mental disorder that would put him off into some hallucinogenic kind of state. And as soon as I read this article, I realized that this is what's happening with Bach. And it's a weird thing because a lot of it has to do with the improvisation that you had mentioned. Charles Lim is a local brain musician guy. He did the very first MRI study of people improvising to see what lights up in the brain when people improvise as opposed to just plain memorized music. And he found that there was a whole different area of the brain that was happening, and it got rid of the everyday kind of thing and sent you into what I think is similar to this transcendent hallucinogenic state that Chopin perhaps might have been in. And so if you connect somebody with all the skills and craft that Bach had, and if he's used to going into this other world of improvisation, which the brain lights up have shown, perhaps that was his kind of a way into some other kind of space that allowed him to take advantage of all the skills and all the chops that he had to create such emotional and powerful music. And I mean, it's hard. We don't know much about this guy. We know we have his music and so on. But it's interesting to think about, why is he the greatest composer that ever lived? And everybody agrees. I mean, even you heard the Tomasani's New York Times thing. Who was the greatest composer? Everybody in it.
Oh, right.
Bach came out on
top.
Absolutely.
Right.
No doubt about it. I mean, and everybody agrees, you know.
And one of the things Phil Glass also said in the conversation with him, that Bach, like Einstein, as he mentioned, visualized music. He felt it, saw it, heard it, and then he put it down on paper.
And the same thing is with Bach, because he was so fluent in the system of notation that we had at the time of the Baroque that he didn't need to play it. Most composers will write at the keyboard, but he could think it all through in his head, hear it all, and essentially write it down. Or he could do an improvisation. In fact, Christoph Wolff says that much of his music was improvised and later written down.
Was Christoph Wolff – who was the one who was doing the piano duel in your film?
That was John Baylis and Anatoly Larkin. But Christoph Wolff is considered the greatest Bach scholar today. He was only briefly in the film. In fact, he's coming to Christ Lutheran next month to do a lecture when they're doing a performance of the B minor Mass. But he was the one that talked about the improvisation in the film and set it up. So to have, you know, most people don't think of Bach as an improviser, but. Back in his day, and even in the day of Mozart and Beethoven, these people improvised all the time. It's just kind of lost today as an art form for classical players.
I found that interesting, this part of the film, because when you talk about one of the couple things around that. One was that the conversation that the two pianists had that we were just talking about, they, in that part of the film, we talked about there were duels. Like young people in the street have poetry slams where they go at each other in poetry. Bach did this with pianos and harpsichord and music in public. That they would go at these contests.
I know. That was the thing that they liked to do. That was the entertainment, and it was the fun to watch, and nobody knew what was going to happen. Of course, the great story is Marchand, the French guy who listened to Bach warm it up and said, "Hey, I'm getting out of here. This guy, there's no chance I'm going to come out on top of that guy."
That's a great part of the film.
Yeah, true story, yeah.
Also, Hilary Hahn, the great young violinist, who had the great fortune to interview when she was just a kid at 15, breaking out into the world.
Yeah.
She said in the film, she wondered in the film how Bach was seen in his day at his time.
I always felt an affinity with Bach's solo violin music. A lot of people forget, I think, that Bach was so active as a violinist. And he got his first job as a violinist. Bach, I find to be a very progressive composer, an active proponent of innovation. His use of chromaticism and his invention of line within harmony is really very imaginative, and I wonder how it was perceived in his time. I think actually he was quite out there. He was experimenting very much like someone like Schoenberg. Most people think of Schoenberg as an academic composer, as a method composer, but I don't think either of them intended to be methodical. I think they were writing what they felt, and I think they were giving themselves structures so that they would be even freer to write. And the pure emotional nature of both of their music is often quite overlooked.
He was such an improviser, taking music to levels people never had imagined before he began composing.
That's absolutely true, and you do have to wonder about it, because I sight read at the piano every day, Bach, okay? And when you start playing along and all of a sudden he never goes the way that you normally would think you would go. And you hit a note and you think, wait a minute, did I hit a wrong note there? And I go back and play. No, that's what he wants to do. I say, oh, that worked terrifically. So he was so inventive and so creative in doing things that people back then, they didn't want all this new stuff. They wanted it the old way, you know what I mean? So he had some trouble, you know, with people accepting him, especially some of the people he worked for in Leipzig and so on. You know, they didn't want this madman there doing all this new stuff.
He had his own tortured life.
Yeah, I think he did, probably in a lot of ways, yeah.
I mean, the one story being told in the film and also about his life, that the woman he fell in love with and losing her at 35, yeah, leaving him with 7 kids.
Yeah.
His drinking.
Oh, I don't think he ever had a drinking problem.
Who was it the film was talking about, his drinking?
Well, I know somebody was saying. I mean, he used to like to have his schnapps and everything, but you can't imagine the busy life that this guy had. I mean, not only did he compose more music than anybody else, I mean, an enormous amount of music. He was a teacher regularly. He ran 2 churches in Leipzig where he had to write music every week for, conduct, arrange, get the parts written out, get the musicians together. On the side, he would do funerals and weddings and things to make a little extra bucks. He had an instrumental rental company. He was renting out harpsichords and different instruments. He was it's unbelievable that he could do all these things. And then he had to deal with the bureaucracy of, you know, and these people didn't appreciate him and everything. In fact, when he got hired in Leipzig, they said, oh, well, we had to take the second best guy, tell him and turn us down. You know?
Michael Lawrence. They know. We'll take a very brief break and come right back. It's called Bach and Friends. It's a 2-hour documentary on Johann Sebastian Bach, interviews and music from some of the finest musicians across this globe. Thank you. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Michael Lawrence, a filmmaker from right here in Baltimore. It's called Bach and Friends. It's a two-hour documentary on Johann Sebastian Bach, interviews and music from some of the finest musicians across this globe. He also played every instrument that he composed for. That was another piece that we don't... That, as Hillary was saying... Hilary Hahn, violin was really his first instrument. He played the harpsichord, he played the organ, he played the wind instruments, he played them all.
Mm-hmm. And of course, then when you write, you know, that makes a big difference when you understand those instruments. But organ was really his main first instrument, and all of his early gigs were playing and writing for the organ and so on. But he had this wonderful period where he wrote instrumental music, the Brandenburgs, the violin pieces, the cello pieces, the partitas, and so on. And that period where he was working in a secular world was so rich, and it's just amazing. In just a few years, when you look at the body of just one piece, the chaconne is just one of the movements of all those the violin pieces, you know, the solo violin pieces, the solo cello pieces. I mean, it's just, I mean, you know, you wonder how anybody can do that. You know, it's like superhuman or something.
And you felt that watching the artists in your film play was also a treat.
Absolutely.
Being lost in their Bach, being lost in their music.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, just to think of spending a day with Joshua Bell recording the
great
chaconne.
Violinist.
And Josh played it through probably 10 times. And, you know, this is a guy that people pay $100 a seat to do a concert. And here we are with a crew. We're working and filming this master playing probably the greatest piece ever written. And it's an enormously difficult piece. And Josh plays it just so beautifully. But what a treat to be able to do that. And also, take Richard Stallman, for example. Richard did actually a keyboard piece, the Chromatic Fantasy. But just to spend the time with him performing this great, great piece that he transcribed for an instrument, of course, that wasn't around when Bach was there. But he plays it so expressively and so beautifully. I would rather have had that than some keyboard player doing the piece.
Absolutely. And your interview with Bobby McFerrin and his both love but also interpretation of Bach and how it just fits the vocal experience.
I got to tell you a story about the Bach violin concerto in A minor, right? I sang the entire concerto with members of the San Francisco Symphony standing behind me in a semicircle. And in the second movement, I got completely turned around and lost. And the musicians were playing, and you could see it in their eyes. Are we going to stop? Are we going to stop? Are we going to start over again? And they were wondering what I was going to do. And so I improvised my way to a spot that I recognized and then took it from there. Anyway, we finished the piece, and intermission comes, and I'm very embarrassed and sorry that I had put them through this experience. And, you know, and I'm apologizing profusely to the players. I was a brand new conductor, and I had messed up and all that kind of stuff. But one of the women was in the orchestra was this older woman, and she came up to me, and she looked at me, and she said, "Bach would have loved it." And it was because, you know, it was improvising. You know, it was just sort of making something up. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that.
Well, the reason Bobby was so important, it was really nice of these guys. None of these people got paid, by the way, that did this movie. They all did it because they loved Bach and wanted to be a part of this crazy adventure. But the thing that I'd always wanted to do is everybody thinks of Bach as this kind of stuffy old guy, you know. But when you feel the music, it just makes you want to dance. And a lot of it is dance music, and it's just so rhythmical and everything. And Bobby was really able to express that. And he, you know, there's a guy that can really feel, you know, he said, "How can you cannot dance to this music? It's, you know, it's so moving." And there's a great story of Bach when he would conduct the Brandenburgs. They would say he would move every bone in his body. I mean, this guy's cooking. You go into a symphony hall now, you won't even see anybody patting their foot. You know what I mean?
Would you just – this is not a digression, I know, Michael, but I tell you, it always blows my mind when I go to the symphony. And everybody just – there's this incredible music being played, and everybody just sits there like nothing's going through them sometimes. It's like they just sit there very straight. And I remember I actually had a woman tap me on my shoulder to ask me to stop moving.
I always feel out of place, too, because I'm moving to the music. Because to me, I feel more involved in the music when I pat my foot and feel the rhythm, and it's a physical thing. And it's nice to know that was happening with Bach, that he could feel the music and all that, too. I don't know where we've gotten. It's a little formal where we are today. But
in terms of what you – in the conversations you had with all these incredible musicians that span, I mean, every instrument Bach composed for and – several genres of music. in terms of what you said earlier in our conversation, which was Bach improvised, and even when he wrote it down, you could see he was improvising in his head as he was writing and doing things with notes that others hadn't done yet that shock you even when you're playing it now in the 21st century. But you also said that somehow we've lost that. That we've lost the ability to take this kind of music and this music and just play with it.
I think we went through a period where even with the correct performance, early performance thing, thinking that trying to figure out a way that the music was performed then and then try to – it kind of puts a little bit of a straitjacket on the way the music's played. And to me, the music works on different instruments. It can be expressive. Take Simona Dinnerstein. She is a wonderful piano.
Oh, absolutely. Amazing.
Just amazing. And, of course, the early people think that she's a little too romantic with it. But she's playing it from her heart the way that she hears
with
it.
With her eyes closed.
And one of my great achievements in this film is I brought Simona and Richard Stalzman together. So they're now performing regularly together. And they're both very lyrical players. Uh-huh. So it is magical. In fact, the new film I'm doing, they're going to do a Da Gamba sonata, which is a real treat. They actually came to the premiere in New York at Symphony Space for Bach and Friends and performed together, which was a real treat.
Oh, for the opening of your film.
Yeah, exactly. Before, when we did the premiere in New York at Symphony Space, we would start off with some live music before the or after the film. And we actually had a lot of people show up. The cello players showed up, Zuhl, and a lot of interesting people showed up.
It's also the way you did this film. I was really intrigued. This is a little step away from Bach just for a minute, though. The way you shot it, you did it I was going to say minimalist, which is really the wrong way to describe it. But it was never kind of excessively done. You were very focused in the work you did, both on the artist, on the instrument they were playing, on the scene around, which I found a really interesting way of doing it.
Well, I'm trying to think. I guess, you know, we tried to find interesting spaces to work in. But more than anything, it's just being able to improvise. Even when Richard and I were shooting, we didn't have exact plans of things we were doing. We were basically improvising as we were going around, trying to find the best shots, trying to find the most interesting way to shoot it. And then with that pile of footage, we had, you know, all these hard drives I had in the studio were, you know, I mean, it's like terabytes and terabytes of high-definition footage. And it was basically having that material to work with that was able to mold it and so on into the final image. But again, it was these little cameras that were, you know, really easy to work with and it created a lovely image. In fact, it was the first time I ever did a film where none of it was recorded on tape. It was all recorded on computer chips.
Even the sound?
The sound was generally recorded on computer chips. Sometimes Don Barto, the sound person, would do a separate double system thing into his little computerized chip. But it was essentially all digitally done. And
Well, you had two wonderful people working with you.
Oh, absolutely. And more than two. There are other.
I'm talking about the two that I know about anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Don Barto did both the sound and the mix. We probably spent, I would say, 2 weeks of doing nothing but all day working on blending the sound. We had good tracks, of course, that Don had started with, but to mix them, mold them, filter them, you know, to make them
lay them back and sync them with the film itself.
Exactly right. Yeah. Right. So it was great fun. Yeah.
So it's in terms of going back to the man of the hour that you made this film about. Before we start this conversation, I said to you, it was unfortunate that one of my favorite interpretations of Bach was not in the film. Of course, these guys are not alive anymore. They're not with us, and you guessed it right away who I was talking about.
Yeah, I don't know how that is. I guess we both love John Lewis. But I actually, in the second film that I'm trying to raise the money for now, have a lot of interesting jazz people. Unfortunately, Dave Brubeck decided not to do it because he just didn't feel, even though he's written a lot of stuff that's very much like Bach, but he's, he gave me a quote from my website. He says he was blown away by the movie. He liked the movie a lot, too. And so there are some really good jazz people that are involved and people I'm involved with. And also, I'm trying to cover some of the areas that I didn't cover in the first one. With this first film, I had so little bit of money. Essentially, I was getting one solo musician, going to some place, filming them, filming an interview, filming them performing, and that was basically a day shoot. I mean, I did 36 shoots on $100,000, which
Wow.
is unbelievably economical with first-rate crew that were working at reduced rates and things like that. So, but this time I had hoped to raise a little more money. It's hard times, but the idea is that I didn't deal with any of the vocal or the sacred music. I didn't really deal much with ensemble music. So the kind of larger things that take a little more money, a little more preparation, a little more time were the things that I was hoping to. So some people complained about this movie because they said it just didn't give you a full image of what Bach did because so much of his, half the music he wrote was vocal, and there really isn't any vocal music in this movie at all other than the Swingle Singers.
And, interpreting, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right, or Bobby McFerrin. But so anyway, that's the goal in trying to get this second film out. It's called Bach and More Friends.
That's great. So this is a continuing series. You're gonna.
Well, I think these two will do it.
This is it. This is gonna,
if I ever make the second one, that's the thing.
I love
the hard times. Yeah.
And if you could think about and for you, what came out of this film for you is in terms of, I mean, you're a musician, you know Bach, you play, you make film. So you walked into this thing with a body of knowledge. But I'm curious what you walked away with that you didn't expect to walk away with.
First of all,
we always do in our projects.
I had 3 years of the most fun in the world. I mean, nobody can have a greater experience than meeting all these wonderful, talented people. And it's like every shoot seemed to get better. And so it was an amazing – I mean, I didn't know. It started off with just a few people, and all of a sudden – all these monster stars.
Look who you have. It's amazing who's in this
film. I know.
Film.
It really is. And then the thing actually is even the most rewarding is once the thing was done, this film has moved a lot of people. I have hundreds and hundreds of emails from people saying that they were brought to tears, that they were moved, that it was spiritual, that, and I think I have over 50 enthusiastic, positive reviews of the movie. I mean, so the thing has really had an impact. And the nice thing is that I was trying to bring young people in because people still have this kind of stuffy image of Bach. And they don't realize how accessible and how emotional this music is. So I was really pushing. The reason you got Bela Fleck in the movie playing it on the banjo or Chris Thiele playing it on the mandolin.
And the ukulele.
And the ukulele. You got Jake Shimabukuro, the great Jake. I mean, it's amazing. And so all these things, these people have opened the music up to a lot of people. So people are finding the Chris Thiele on the YouTube and they're saying, I bought it for that reason. Now I'm a Bach lover. I'm going to iTunes and I'm downloading Bach. And I had one guy say, I've changed my profession. I've decided I'm going to be a musician because of the movie. You know, I have another lady said, I got a 2-year-old kid that loves to watch the movie. So, I mean, that's the thing. To know that you're touching people, I mean, it's really Bach. I mean, I'm presenting it pretty well, but it's the power of Bach. And what that means to people's lives and their personal journey and their spirituality. And it's like Josh said in the beginning of the film, he said, Bach tells you something about life that you can't get any other way.
It's true. I think that one of the things that hit me about that was, again, you'll help me here. We just mentioned his name and place.
Jake Shimabukuro. Yeah. Jake's a talent.
Amazing ukulele player.
Unbelievable.
But these players, what they were saying was that the audiences that they play for and they never hear Bach on the instrument, on the usual music these guys play, that when they hear Bach, they all are mesmerized. They all fall in love. They all say this is the favorite thing they heard that evening.
Let me tell you a story about Jake that's really funny. I had heard Jake he became an internet sensation and just such a great musician. So when he was coming in the area, I contacted his manager and I said, Jake play Bach? Because he's such a wonderful player. And the manager said, oh, he's working on a Bach album. I said, great, would he be in my movie? So we line it up and we come to film and everything. And after we film, Jake comes up to me and says, Mike, he said, I got to tell you the truth. I'm really not working on a Bach album. I just wanted to be part of this film because my idols are Bela Fleck and Chris Thiele and Edgar Meyer. And what a sweet guy and a great musician. He's going through the roof right now. I mean, it's amazing how popular he's becoming.
I think this was just an amazing piece of work and just to understand improvisation, to understand how our creative mind works through the work of Bach and all these incredible musicians and musical thinkers was just amazing. I was absolutely blown away by it.
Well, the thing that I'm most proud of is the quality of the Bach playing.
Yes.
Is really, really high. I mean, I didn't put anything in that movie that wasn't first-rate Bach playing. And in fact, I tell a story. I won't even mention the artist, but a major famous pianist was going to be in the film, and I was didn't check him out enough until I heard a concert of him playing a Bach organ transcription. And it was so un-Bach and so romantic that I canceled the shoot and said I wasn't. I fudged my way out of it and everything. And this guy's a famous guy that I wanted to have in the movie, but the Bach playing was just wasn't up to snuff. So,
well, the stuff in this movie is up to snuff.
Well, I'm lucky to have all these people. I mean, you've got to admit this is a real dream project with a lot of luck going my way.
And happy birthday, Johann Sebastian Bach.
You can see Bach and Friends this Wednesday at Shriver Hall on the Homewood campus of Johns Hopkins University. For tickets or more information, www.shriverconcerts.org or 410-516-7164.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. I'm gonna go to bed.